Success to me is my family, my kids, and being able to give them far more than I ever had.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I'll be speaking with some of the most innovative ideators in culture and trying to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This podcast is brought to you by the good people at Shopify. Feeling that entrepreneurial itch? Turn your passion into a business with Shopify. They've got everything you need to start, run, or grow your business. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Chicago native Hebrew Brantley was always interested in fine art. From an early age, Brantley's mother introduced him to Basquiat and Warhol, and Brantley saw his future in a can of paint. But Brantley's father urged him to consider safer options. So as a compromise, Brantley decided to study film at Clark University in Atlanta. Ironically, in fighting his inclination towards fine art, Brantley would only bring himself closer to the career he ultimately wanted.
My father worked for NBC when I was coming up. Worked in spot sales, ad sales. My mother worked for JPC, which, is Ebony Jet. And she was Mr. Johnson's secretary. And being around them, one, it normalized having access or exposure to people that were influencers, celebrity, whatever the word you want to use. But like seeing them, and it felt normal. They didn't feel, it didn't feel like unreachable or, Like, oh, I just watched them on TV last night. And now they're right there. There goes Luther Vandross. There goes, So I think having that experience with them allowed me to position myself in a space where like I didn't feel like goals were unobtainable, or certain goals were unobtainable. And but beyond that, I think my mom nor my father never really were artistic, but my mom appreciated it. And, even in her side businesses and things that she ran, like there was always opportunity to be creative, and she would, allow for me to participate in that. I think adversely, like my father was very much like, go to school, you get good grades, and you get a good job, right? Like this artist shit, that's not real. It was like, you want to do art? Okay, well, be an architect, right? That has art in it. You got a pencil in your hand at some point, right? But it was never promoted in the way, it was like, live your dream, do this, do that. It was like, get a good job, And it's like your parents, they want the best for you. So it was that, but it was the opposite from my mother. It was like, oh, you like art? Okay, well, let's find this. Hey, you ever heard of Basquiat? You ever heard of Warhol? You know, Warhol paints Superman. You ever see this? Hey, you heard this guy Keith Haring? So thanks to my mom that like a lot of these things were put in front of me at an early age. As a kid, the thing that I did most natural was, want to draw, color, create. You're mimicking the things you like, the Ninja Turtles and, drawing these things and He-Man and, it's all of that and it's innocent. And then it was like Wu-Tang happened, and then it was like an awakening. I don't want to be a kid no more. But also, these guys are doing a thing within music that like I can visualize, I can see, and they're taking elements of things that I grew up loving, cartoons, anime, kung fu flicks, Shaw Brothers shit, and hip-hop, emerging them all together. Why can't I do something similar in, a visual medium? That was a big aha moment, and that was like a next level of development. And then, it was also like the time where like hip hop was elemental. And so I found my peers and I found my, and that was my way into doing art on a bigger scale. There was one artist named Design who took it to another level. He started in a space of like traditional graffiti, but then he started doing these huge compositions that went beyond graffiti, that went into more of the abstract, and that really was like a big aha moment too for me, where it's like seeing this guy do these things. And then he was sort of the first guy I saw, I guess, do street art, art that wasn't, that was public, that wasn't sort of sanctioned by, a city or an entity, but also was like, wasn't graffiti. I had a stepbrother that was older, and he was heavy into skateboarding. He would get a lot of those skateboard mags and a lot of graffiti mags. And that's where I found Dondi. And like, that dude was cold, bro. Like, he was just fucking cold. And even he kind of became more and more iconic through not just the pictures of his work, but the pictures of him actually putting up stuff, right? And then you find movies like Wild Style and, you know, obviously Beat Street that like really sort of celebrated the artist and like it just made that shit seem so alluring and like it was so cool. And so, you know, it was like a lot of those New York guys that never really got their shines, you know, I was really, really, really attracted to what they were doing in their art. And then as art started to come off the streets, and I know this is a very divisive thing in the moment within the culture, but as the art start coming off the streets and into the galleries in that 80s movement, you know, like that was also sort of a great moment for me in terms of seeing how that works from an application standpoint, right? Like if these guys' main medium is spray paint, right? Spray paint isn't an easy medium to manipulate, right? And especially at the time where like different caps and sizes weren't necessarily available, right? But watching a guy like Dondi do it at a level that he was doing it at both in the streets and in the gallery, I thought was really exceptional.
While you're doing this, is this just having fun, expressing yourself, or are you thinking about where this is going to take you or what the applications beyond recreation could be?
At the time, no, man. I was just like, this is fun, right? I get to pal around, you know, I get to just be around the homies. All that energy is the same. You know, it's rambunctious. We just out in the streets doing it. But for me, you know, I always just wanted to make art, you know, and I didn't for the longest time really think about where that takes me because there was no one set sort of archetype or pathway towards this thing, right? It was like, okay, you want to be an animator, you want to work in animation, that's one route, right? I wasn't good enough for that. I wasn't a traditionalist in that path, and I found it really hard dealing with, like, you know, proper proportions and body size and things like that. And, you know, you want to be a comic book artist, wasn't good enough for that. My heroes looked weird as shit sometimes, you know, and different angles I had trouble with. And so I didn't really know which way I was going to go, but I knew that I really enjoyed creating my own stuff, my own characters and things like that. But there wasn't, again, design wasn't designed by then, you know, so I didn't have like a North Star to point to. So I was just kind of like, this is fun. This is what we're doing.
When you get to the end of high school, did you have a sense that you wanted to pursue art in a professional way?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to go, you know, I wanted to go to art school, like traditional. I wanted to go to, you know, Pratt or Art Institute. But my father, for him, it's just he didn't want me to suffer and starve, like the lure of the starving artist, right? He didn't want me to have to go down that path. And so one of my other loves and passion has always been film. And so, you know, I think a compromise for the both of us was like, I can go to Clark Atlanta, right? They had a film program, it's the undergrad program that Spike went through, Spike Lee. And, you know, I can appease him, get my degree in that, blah, 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 and still do my creative, whatever I need to do, but working towards something. And I think for him, the thought was that like, at least I can, you know, be on some crew doing something at some level, but I'll have a job, right? I'll be able to make a way.
You go to Clark with the intention to get involved in film. Was there a specific role or part of the industry that you were looking?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a director, I think, because to me that was the job or the role on a film set that I understood, you know, pretty simple and plain, right? I didn't know what a cinematographer really did. You know, I understood it to a degree, but like to me, if a director sort of oversaw these things and brought the people together, put this thing together in a way, talk with that, like, okay, I can understand that. You know what I mean? And so that was sort of the most appealing. And then, you know, again, like looking at certain directors, right, growing up, right? Like, again, the Spike Lees, more notable, you know, other black directors, Robert Townsend, you know, doing comedy and not sort of having to stick to, you know, sort of traditional black films, right? But branching out, doing, you know, from the Five Heartbeats to Meteor Man. Like, that shit was really appealing to me, and I went to learn how to do that.
Brantley was headed to Clark Atlanta for film, but his passion for drawing persisted. So when he should have been working on film projects in his free time, more often than not, Brantley found himself sketching. Finally, he would gain access to facilities at a nearby art school, and Brantley would get his hands on the supplies he needed to fully realize his ambition.
I really found out quickly that Clark's film program wasn't as, you know, good as it maybe once was, right? Like, their concentration was more on TV and radio. You know, Clark, they had a radio station. It's the Jazz station for Atlanta. It's on campus, right? It's in the communications building. TV, they have a public access channel that's right on campus. A lot of the students were, you know, heavily focused their attention on, and there was like a small cluster group of us that were like, you know, film nerds and the folks that really, you know, got deep on the film shit. And it was more left up to us to make some things happen. And, you know, we did, we made, you know, short films, we made, you know, straight to, you know, DVD films, you know, they got kind of picked up by, you know, distribution companies. But it was more towards my, like, end of my junior year into my senior year when I started working for different production companies and directors, right? It was like that time in Atlanta where, you know, hip hop had moved from New York down south. This is like 97, 98. And so, you know, you got like Ludacris, you got obviously Outkast. You got a lot of different acts now straight out of Atlanta. And so more opportunity to get work, you know, in some capacity on a crew. And, you know, as I was working and starting out doing internships, you know, obviously they found out I could draw, so I would be kind of placed in that box, like doing storyboards, doing concept art for things. And that was cool, but it just got to a point where, like, there was no real challenge to it. All those videos, for the most part, and this is not to, like, you know, tear anybody down, but a lot of those videos were the same, right? Unless you're Hype Williams, and Hype had the budgets to do crazy shit, but even that started having a formula to it, right? But it was like, you know, the slow pan with the artist, the crystal pouring, the booties, the cute girls, da da da. It wasn't much involved from an artistic standpoint that, like, I could really help sell a thing. And so a lot, you know, a lot of these guys, these directors, these production companies would come to me and ask me to, you know, because they're bidding for these jobs, so they need art for it. And it just became kind of boring. And then, like, you know, it was like handshake deals. I didn't get paid sometimes, and that shit was discouraging, right? Or, like, I wouldn't get paid for the job I did, right? I'd get paid for, you know, some menial task. And, like, well, what about this video? I had, like, five of my paintings or, you know, drawings in here. Can I get paid for that, too? And, you know, I was like, no. It was a little discouraging. And at the time, I was still, like, you know, drawing and painting so much, and it just was a thing where, like, it was weird, man. It's like the universe just sort of, you know, putting you in the place that you're supposed to be. And so, like, at the time, you know, I was about to have my first kid, you know, trying to figure out, like, how I'm gonna make money, right? I'm still fucking in school. And I was working a job at a restaurant, and it just so happened that the restaurant was right across the street from the art college in Atlanta. So a lot of the art students worked at the restaurant. And, you know, during my shifts, like, I would, you know, sit in back booth and just draw. And they found out I could draw, so they started inviting me over to the school. And, dude, it, like, opened my eyes. I had never been to art school proper. So it opened my eyes, and it was like, holy shit, like, this is how y'all have access to this 24/7. This is how y'all get down. And so I just started going as often as I could. Like, I was living at the school to the point where, like, the staff, the janitorial staff, the security didn't even ask for my ID. And they would let me in, buzz me in, because they saw me over there all the time. They just assumed he goes here. And so I would use the resources at the school to do what I needed to do because I didn't have the space at home. And even to the point where, like, got cool with the janitorial staff, right? Every semester, you know, you've got kids taking classes that are like, you know, painting one, drawing one, and that's not their focus, right? So they don't give a shit about, you know, painting supplies or something like that. So, you know, at the end of the semester, they clean out lockers, right? Or classrooms, and it's all this surplus of, like, half-used supplies. And so they hit me to it, and I, you know, pulled a car up. Take paintings, you know, paint over them, like half-painted paintings, you know, art supplies, big stacks of, you know, paper and whatever. And that really helped fund my sort of art education. I wasn't paying for it. You know, it wasn't like everything had to be a hit, right? I could miss, I could fail, and I didn't feel bad about it. Those 2 years became like my arts education.
What were sort of the fundamental things that you walked away from that experience that you feel like have informed the decisions you made since?
I mean, one was just that I could do this, right? Like that there was something there beyond just a want, right? But being in that environment, seeing a lot of these kids that like, you can draw, you like to do these things, you have a creative sort of bone in your body, so go to art school, figure it out. But a lot of these people aren't meant to be artists, right? Aren't meant to be in that space, you know, directly, right? Maybe indirectly representing, working for certain companies, et cetera. But I got to see that very clear in meeting a lot of these kids and talking through ideas. And even though for some of them I was like a year or two older, I felt far older and far more experienced coming from where I came from than a lot of them, right? And you know, it was a thing where like, I remember one day I was in a friend of mine's like studio painting class, and I just was crashing, you know, I'd been crashing in class a couple times to the point where like I had a piece I was working on in the class, and like the instructor like really, really rocked with it and like used me as like kind of an example of like how to do a certain thing. It takes more than just passion sometimes, right? You know, and especially with art, like having a deeper understanding of, you know, how and more so the why, right? Why am I doing this, right? What does this mean? What does this represent? I think in seeing that really helped me gain a sense of confidence that I was on the right path towards something bigger. A lot of folks in art school or in that school at the time were kind of basically copying some masters, you know, like doing their version of a thing that they saw, right? Like it's the Van Gogh style of oil painting. I'm doing figurative work, or the Basquiat copycat, or whoever. But like they were doing their version of a thing where mine felt sort of more wholly original. I feel like art school beats you down, you know, like in a way that it should, right? It's like a little reality check. But I think that like, especially for a lot of my friends that went through certain art programs, right? Everybody's not built for that level of certain scrutiny. And I know it prepares you for sort of the real world, but it also can rob you of like the moment to allow an artist to grow in a way, right? It sort of can force growth, and that's not always a good thing, right? It's like can force you to kind of do what you feel you think is right, or what you feel like your instructor will be okay with. That'll get you the passing grade, that'll get you, you know, into a space where it puts you in their good graces. And I think that like it's tough for a lot of people to sort of deal with that. And then, you know, it gets to a point where it's like, you know what, I don't want to do this no more. It's not fun anymore. It takes the wind out of certain people watching that, but feeling the opposite of that. I want you to judge me. I want you to tell me if you think my shit is whack. I don't want to walk through life thinking I'm doing the greatest shit ever. I want constructive criticism and things like that. And I think that that environment supported that, but I got that from peers, less the instructors, because I wasn't in the class. But again, having that moment where I do get it from an instructor was just like a big sort of eye-opening moment where it's like, oh, okay, I'm doing something that's actually pretty good. It was something completely different from what everybody else was sort of focused on in the moment. I was really looking at, I think, movements that were happening that weren't necessarily like front and center, right? It was a little outsider art in a lot of ways. It was that blended with sort of this sprinklings of graffiti or, you know, street art, and it was cultural, but it was like, it was something different. And it was something that like I really hadn't seen before in mass. And so looking at those movements to understand that there was opportunity there to be wholly original and find an audience, you know, I didn't necessarily, still didn't know how I was going to go about doing that, but just in seeing like those guys do it and seeing certain artists on the East Coast that weren't traditional artists, you know, still getting those shines, putting on heavyweights, seeing those guys do basically live DJ sets and art shows, you know, like that was dope. Just seeing that there was an opportunity to be a creative, to be a visual artist that didn't necessarily fit within the traditional view of what a painter sort of does day to day, right? You know, typically you create a body of work, it goes into a gallery, a stuffy space, white walls, white wine, white women, and that's it, right? And these guys were creating opportunities to say, no, it goes beyond that, right? And there was an audience for it and there was a hunger for it. And so that was enough for me to know that I want to play in that space.
Creatively, Brantley was ready to go all in on his career as a painter. But financially, he was not ready to make the leap to fully supporting himself and his newborn child off his art alone. So in addition to selling paintings, Brantley started flipping clothes, designing concert posters, styling artists, and creating industry connections in both Atlanta and back home in Chicago.
When was the first time that you made a work that you felt like, I found my voice?
I didn't find my voice in that time, but I think it was just one of those aha moments. But it was also like sort of a failure kind of moment, right? Where it's like not knowing, you know, that you can't mix oil and acrylic, right? Or one has to come before the other in order to do it successfully. And so, you know, in creating a certain piece, I don't even think I titled it, but it was just one of those works that like, I was just vibing, man. And it was like everything worked in that piece. And, you know, slowly over the course of next couple of weeks and months, those two different elements weren't bonding together. And, you know, it just completely was something that was just like unsalvageable. But it was still a like, this is my route. This is where I feel most comfortable and most sort of at ease. It was like the first time I had done maybe some character work that didn't necessarily feel like it drew back to the origins of sort of like traditional graffiti styles, you know? It felt, it was this sort of hybrid between the worlds where it just felt like, it felt new in that moment, right? It felt like something I hadn't seen before. And it was just, you know, it just felt good. It was like, okay, yeah, this is working. Like, I can see a way forward. My homegirl basically kind of taught me how to paint for real. Like, this is how you really get down. Her seeing the growth from that moment of like those early teaching moments to this thing and us being able to kind of talk through it. And because she had a sense of the history, right? The journey so far. And, you know, that really helped kind of instill a sense of confidence. And she was a fucking amazing painter, still is. That really helped the confidence and like thrust forward. One thing that kind of skipped over in school was like the Moschine era, you know, with the hand-painted, puff-painted shirts. You know, they were out of Philly, crushing it, obviously. And I'm a painter, I can do that. And for me, I was like, well, shit, I can do characters, I can do certain things, da 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 da. And so I started doing that. And then we'd have like Market Thursdays and Fridays. So on Clark's campus, it was like Market Thursday, you just set up a table, you didn't need a permit or anything, right on the promenade, sell whatever. And then Fridays was on Spelman's campus. And Drum would just, he had a table selling his mixtapes. This is back like, you know, DJ Dramatic. Basically like, you know, his hip hop love song mixtapes and then his harder, you know, hip hop mixtapes. He'd sell those and then I'd have a table next to him sometimes just selling, you know, t-shirts, jackets, trucker hats, like hand painted. And the demand, it grew and grew and grew so fast to the point where I went to the art school and like, hired a few other youngins to kind of help and be my ghost painters. Like, it was formulaic, so it was like an easy thing, but like it was a factory type of thing. And that really helped put me through my last kind of 2 years of school. You know, the thing that really helped me out was I had a buddy who was pretty big for Urban Outfitters, and they had some like distribution center. At one point in time, they did like all these repurposed camo jackets and shirts, like from old fatigue. I guess they made more than they could sell. So there was like a container full of them. And so I took all the money I had and just bought them like wholesale, like for dirt cheap. And it was a bunch of t-shirts, and a bunch of their trucker hats, and just took them to the crib. And I was, you know, selling a shirt for 75, $100. I bought these hats for like $1 or $2 a piece. And so, you know, it just became a thing. And then, you know, Atlanta being the hub for entertainment and music at the, well, mostly music at the time, like different stylists for these rappers would hit me up we're doing a video for, I'm not gonna name names, but we're doing a video for this person or this person. They've got a shoot with Source or Vibe. I need a thing, I need some options. And so they would commission me for, you know, different stuff. And obviously the commission prices were a little higher. It still wasn't big money, but you know, it added up. And to the point where like, I could pay for school.
Were there any music videos where we can see your work?
I think there's a Lil Flip video or two where I did a few shirts for Lil Flip. I know Drom's worn a shirt or two in like interviews, and then I think in the issue of The Source or Vibe, I can't remember. But yeah, I mean, and then, you know, all the lower end publications, there was a million hip hop publications at the time. Even while I was painting and trying to do the fine art stuff, I didn't let that go because it was such a thriving business, at least for the next 3 years. So like, I just was trying to do it a little bit more professional. So I had like a store in Chicago called Leaders. Right, they would place an order for shirts and I'd send them out, you know, a bunch of shirts. Okay, great, boom, sell in there. And then, you know, a few stores in Atlanta, I would fulfill orders, do the things for them, boom, they'd sell out, just re-up.
The world of fine art really turned its nose up at pop, anything really. As you're trying to break in there, was there a tension between this commercial work that you're doing and the fine art?
I think it was to a degree, but at the same time, it didn't really matter to me because I was feeding my kid, you know, and I was surviving off of it. So it was like, this is my way forward. The art world is governed by an entire set of rules that aren't written anywhere, right? And it just depends on how the wind is blowing and who the gatekeepers are that are, you know, instituting these rules. And seeing that early on and understanding that, like, if you don't want me in your gallery, I just won't be in your gallery.
You get to the end of college, you now have a child and financial obligations. Did you end up taking a 9-to-5 job or did you go straight into being a full-time artist?
I'm not a good employee, but I did for a second, for like a hot second, I took a basically glorified doorman, right? In like really expensive condo building in Peachtree in Atlanta, like close to Lenox Mall. When you think of like a doorman, like a certain age, you know, 40s, 50-year-old black guy, you know, like that's the whole crew. And then there's me, you know, this young artist that like, I literally am wearing my only suit, you know, to work every day. And I was just bad at it. I had the night shift and, you know, there's cameras everywhere and I would like draw. And after the first week, it was like, all right, Hebrew, you gotta stop drawing. You know, you gotta do your rounds. You gotta do this. Okay, I do that and to find a camera angle. So I draw away from, you know, the angles. And then a month or so in, these people drive on the lawn of the property. And dude, I was working night shift. It's like 4 a.m. I'm exhausted. I'm not thinking properly. They mess up the property, basically. And I let them go before the police get there properly filing reports. So I got fired, right? And it was just a thing where it's like, I hated the job anyway. And I just got to a point where it's like, well, if I'm gonna work, I want to do something that's within the space of creation. Whatever that is, as long as I'm creating and making something, I'm good. And so the next series of things that I did were all sort of in that space, you know? And then it was like teaching myself Photoshop. Atlanta's 20 parties a week. There's 40 promoters that need flyers. All right, I can make these little ghetto flyers, put a little hot girl here, Photoshop her here with the champagne bottles and the car in the background, you know, like No Limit album covers. I looked at it as a way of like, one, I'm hustling, but two, this is also keeping me in that space, right? And I'm learning something. It's not necessarily the art that I want to do, but, you know, I'm working towards sort of a bigger thing here, but I'm learning how to do all this stuff. I'm learning the mechanics of, you know, this program and yada, yada, yada. So it was always that, you know, and then it just sort of hit a point where like, again, Atlanta, small market, very small market, especially when it comes to fine art. And so, you know, it was like, it's time to take the show on the road. It's time to move, time to figure it out, next steps.
Creating art takes a certain level of selfishness. Being a father takes a certain level of selflessness. How did you navigate that as you were trying to cut your teeth and get your first foothold into the game?
I mean, it was difficult, like, not gonna lie, you know, especially being a father at such a young age. But I think it kind of worked in the way that, like, you know, I was coming out of school, right? And my son's mom was, you know, obviously took a pause and then was going back to school. And so, like, I would have him during the days, you know, and some evenings, but using that time, whenever he's got his head to a pillow, I'm in the living room painting, obsessively just creating. And so I think it was like, it was a pretty easy balance. And I'm grateful for her because I think that, you know, she understood to the degree in which she could my ambition and supported it, you know. I never really got shit from her about that aspect of you know, what I wanted to do. And my mom was in full support, right? They don't know the proper things to say to even help guide, you know. And I didn't really know. I'm just doing a thing, you know, constantly. And it was an easier balance than I think it could have been. But also it was like, it was very apparent, like, you know, I was a young guy raising a kid, I had a son, and that also was an extreme motivator. That's the reason you go even harder. And yeah, I can go another hour. You know, yeah, you know, I'll pass on that. I'm gonna stay here and I'm gonna do this. And so it absolutely did, but it also brought about another motivation, which I didn't realize, or another thing where, like, having him allowed me to go back to being a child in certain aspects, where, you know, as you grow up, especially, you know, around certain people, you sort of give away all your childhood appreciation for certain things, right? Cartoons, again, comics, all of these things that, like, were me, you know, inherently me, the things that I loved, I pushed to the side, mostly out of fear of ridicule and what folks would say. I mean, hell, even my art to a certain degree with certain folks, right? Like, I definitely have my tribe, but being an artist in that time wasn't cool, right? It was the least thing from being cool. It was seen as being negative, and it was horrible. And I had to hide a lot of that, but having him showed me how silly that was. This is the thing that I'm relying upon to help feed him, right? But then on the other side of that, like, sitting watching SpongeBob and not feeling a way about it, right? And really being into it. And then being able to, like, you know, as parents do, like, you know, you want to hip your kids to, like, the stuff you grew up on. You know what I mean? I used to watch this as a kid. You fall back in love with those things and those moments when, you know, you were that age and that level of nostalgia. And that really helped unlock something for me. It was like, this is the truest version of me, right? And what I've been doing up until this point creatively hasn't been the full version.
Looking to Basquiat and other 80s contemporary artists for inspiration, Brantley continued to navigate the industry and find his voice as a creator. After moving back to Chicago and landing a job teaching art to children, Brantley gained access to the resources necessary to take his art career to the next level. Have you ever had a big idea but lacked the tools to implement it? Look no further than Shopify. Shopify is the brand that powers all your favorite clothing, beauty, and sneaker brands and offers the best-in-class commerce tools to allow you to sell online, in person, and on all major social platforms. Shopify fuels millions of entrepreneurs and turns ambition into action. Check out shopify.com/idea to learn more. Now back to the story.
You understood the craft and you knew how to paint and you knew how to make things. But figuring out the what or the why is, I think, probably the most challenging part for anyone, really, but a fine artist in particular. Sure. How did that come into focus for you?
An older artist told me one time, like, obviously, you know, paint what you know, right? Looking at my early work, some of it was good, some of it was horrible, but not seeing, you know, me throughout all of it. And I couldn't disagree. I felt that, you know, because it was like trying to paint what I thought people wanted as opposed to what I wanted people to see. For artists of color, black artists, period, right? There were, like, boxes you checked for art, you know, or the perception of black art was like, this is some shit that we're going to talk about, you know, the slave fields, right? The old times before I existed, before they existed. We're going to do sort of like the jazz club scene, right? We're going to delve into some historical things and just sort of repurpose those memories, those moments, and that aesthetic, right? Whether, again, you're doing that from an abstract perspective or just, you know, something that is sort of photoreal or somewhere in between. And that's kind of where things lived. I think Basquiat was obviously the exception. What he did was wholly unique to, you know, anything anybody was doing. But for me, at the time, it was like, you know, I'm such a fan of that 80s movement. Not just of Basquiat, but like, again, of Warhol, you know, Schnabel, all those guys that were sort of moving around in that space at the time. I think a lot of young Black artists especially find Basquiat and his work becomes sort of a jumping off point to an understanding of fine art. Your style tends to lean more Basquiat-ish, right, in certain ways. Mine did, for sure. And I see a lot of young artists still to this day do it. But for me, you know, it got to a point kind of after high school where it's like, man, I've been following this dude since I was a youngin', within the capacity I could. And now the world is starting to, like, understand who this guy is and his sort of output and, you know, creative prowess and really appreciate him. And now there's T-shirts, there's mugs. And it's like, this dude never got to see a check for any of that, participate in any of that, have any input in any of that. That doesn't take away from the fact that some of this shit is cool and I want it, but like, I want to be able to take something from here and put it on a coffee mug, right? And somebody that can't afford that can afford that and they can live with my art in their home. I don't see why you shouldn't. When you go to a museum, right? What's the thing of a museum? You exit through the gift shop, right? And this is the contradictory, the nature of the fucking art world, right? We're going to tell you that commercial art is not the way to go, that you shouldn't do that. But we're going to exploit dead artists and license their shit up the wazoo to sell you puzzles, postcards, books, T-shirts, et cetera, through our museum gift shop. And it's okay to do it there. But if you do it in any other arena, oh, no, it's public, it's bad. You're not supposed to do that.
What was the first moment where you felt like, this is gonna work?
I wasn't reliant on a gallery or a gallery owner or, you know, any sort of institution. I've been watching, you know, these different collectives and different groups and how they were sort of moving. And like, it just made the most sense to me to try to have obviously the most control early on. And I knew a lot of people and, you know, had friends that were sort of making their way up and, you know, in different industries. And so finding a vacant spot, making some deal with the landlord, you know, whether that's a day, a week, a month, and just doing my own shows. You know, that was something that was sort of an idea early on. If you're trying to find that gallery, you're trying to find a place where you feel like your work can fit or like you best connect with the representation there. And for me, I didn't really like that world, right? Like I felt like an outsider always in a lot of those instances. I would go to galleries, I'd go to shows, I'd talk with gallery owners at that age. And I just felt like we didn't speak the same language. The thing I did understand was, you know, the presentation fact. It's like, you have something you want to show, you put on a show and you show it. You open the doors. And that was pretty simple to me. And so that's sort of where it started. It was like, man, we got this space, got the art hung, invite the friends, invite friends of friends. We got music, we've got, you know, some free booze, make the shit look better. The more drinks you have anyway, you know, come on in and let's figure it out. And that's sort of, you know, where it started. The third or fourth year out of school is when I really start to lean into the notion of like, making something that felt like my own, you know? And that was also around the same time where like, I had just moved back to Chicago. And I think that like, not having seen a lot of these guys that I grew up with, not being around those people anymore, you go away, you always grow, you know? And sometimes those folks that don't leave don't necessarily grow as fast. And I think them seeing me, seeing what I was up to, right? Letting them in on these are my ideas, these are my thoughts, really helped accelerate that growth within me and within the art, you know, where it's like pushing me towards a direction and having to sort of make a decision as opposed to sort of trying to do everything. Like moving back to Chicago, I was teaching art at this spot on the South Side called Little Black Pearl, right? It was just a workshop spot. So it wasn't like, you know, school, sort of an after school thing. And, you know, some great Chicago artists have come from there. One most notably is Theaster Gates, who is, you know, obviously like art royalty. If you know, you know. The energy of youth, man, is it can be infectious. And not being restrained to a certain curriculum, right? Like I made the curriculum. So I gave them the shit that I thought was cool, right? And I'm still at the age where like I'm not too old for them, right? And the shit I'm doing is not corny. And I think that a lot of the instructors there were, you know, they were older, you know, 10, 20 years older than I was. And so my studio became more of the favorite studio because there was more of a youthful energy there. Like, we listened to hip hop every day. We watched certain movies, and I put certain things in front of them that I felt was more appealing to, like, their sensibilities. But, you know, at the same time, like, this was the first time I'm in an environment where, like, I have free reign over a studio, a huge art studio, right? I can stay at this building as late as I want and get down, right? And so it allowed me freedom to stretch out where I'd never had that flexibility before. You know, obviously, as a creative, like, when you're not confined and, you can breathe a little bit, dope shit's gonna happen. That was a short period of time, which I taught, but it was enough to kind of really help set me on a path where, like, I felt confident enough from leaving that job to never having a job again. At the time, Chicago had, like, these different groups of, like, these diaspora art collectors. I mean, the range of, like, the young mid-30s, you know, early 40s-something to 50s and 60s-something that, like, I just got my house and I'm putting art in it, too. I built a very established art collection. And they would, you know, go to each other's houses and have wine and cheese and talk art and talk, you know, culture and da-da-da-da, come visit artist studios and, you know, getting to know some of them, how they moved. Okay, bet. Guess what I'm going to carry with me all the time? Artwork. You know, I'm going to carry little pieces of artwork on cards. You know, again, however I can get it, I'm going to move around and be able to sell it. And I think that my work at the time was so unlike all of the things that were being offered in that space. Not even sure if they liked it, but just being taken aback because it was so different that they had to engage with it, you know, and they had to own it. But it gave me that confidence. It was like, you know, these are the people that are a huge part of the Chicago art scene, the collector scene. They're rocking with me strong, right? So these are the people I want to engage with more than just my peers, right? My peers can be like, yeah, that shit's dope. That doesn't mean nothing. That doesn't put any money in my pocket. That doesn't excel my career to a point. But these people, these collectors that are the mouthpieces for the artists to get these artists into not only other collections, galleries, museums, these are the people that are now giving me attention. And so it just really helped, man. It boosted that confidence. And again, you creating from a place of confidence, it always will naturally accelerate your game and what you do.
Brantley had become one of the hottest names in the local gallery scene, and his confidence was at an all-time high. But a sudden illness in the family forced Brantley to reprioritize his time and his resources, and soon he found himself struggling to make ends meet.
Right when I finally left the teaching job and going out on my own and doing my own thing, finally getting my first studio, making enough money to just survive off of the art, like, my mom got sick. And right after that, my stepdad got sick. And my mom had breast cancer, and she beat it, went into remission, was fine. But it came back aggressive. When it did, you know, she was trying everything she could. And then in that process of her going to chemo and getting treatment, my stepfather finds out that he has pancreatic cancer. As I'm feeling like I'm taking some real strides, I'm the oldest. I have two younger siblings. And what I have going on in my life is not as important right now as what my mom has to deal with. And so I stopped a lot and helped her. I'm waking up early, packing lunches, taking my brother and sister to school, picking them up from school, taking her to, you know, to her treatments. And shortly after, you know, again, finding all this out, my stepfather passes, you know, and with him passing, you know, my parents weren't super rich or wealthy, but they did okay. My stepfather, he did, you know, pretty good. But with treatments and hospital visits and, like, that shit adds up, you know. Like, our healthcare system is a joke, right? Like, an aspirin costs $200 in a hospital, right? And so the bills were stacking up. And, you know, when I was younger, my late teens, I loved art, obviously. And so my parents, you know, they started kind of getting into it. They had a little bit more disposable income. And so they started buying artwork, you know, a few things here or there, and made some really good purchases. And so we had to sell our collection to pay down our expenses. And so, you know, watching them go through that, and then it became harder to paint. It became harder to create because I had, you know, this burden of, like, I'm raising my siblings at this point. And my mom's health, it never came back. And so right around that time, I had an opportunity to do my first solo show in Chicago. So I'm working at night, every night, painting my ass off. I'm literally, dude, I'm down to like just a few shekels now in the bank account because I've already left the job. But this thing happened right after that. And I'm putting everything I got into this work. And the day of the show, my mom's never been to an art show because I'd had all my shows in Atlanta at the time, right? She has my brother and sister. She wasn't able to fly, you know, to come to an art show. Like, and it's everything to me. My biological father's coming. My mom's coming, you know, separately. But dude, I'm driving my mom back from treatment and she literally, I can't make this shit up, she goes blind. And it's like temporary thing that happens sometimes with chemo. She loses sight for a couple hours. And it terrified me and it just put me in this place of panic. But she was too weak to come to the show. So throughout my life, my mom never got to see me have an art show. But my father showed up and obviously it was great. But it was just crazy, you know, having to sort of deal with that. And then, you know, soon thereafter, she passed away. And I found myself in a crazy position of raising my own son and then now having full custody of my brother and sister as a visual artist. Right? Like, I don't have a secure gig. And, you know, there were bills. Man, I was doing everything. I was, like, going to nightclubs and doing live painting gigs for a couple hundred dollars. It would be worst shit ever. Like, you're painting in a dark room, right? And then you got drunk idiots meandering around, bumping into you, asking you dumbass questions like, man, what you doing? You painting? You know, like, clearly, dude. But it was whatever I could do to, you know, pay some stuff down. And my brother and sister at the time were in private school. I couldn't afford private school. So y'all got to come out of that. But, you know, luckily, man, again, this is luck, right? Like the parents at the private school, like who my mom had befriended, pulled together to help pay her tuition in school, right? So it wasn't that much of a shift for her, obviously having to deal with the loss of both of her parents, but then have to leave all her friends. Like, she could go back to that world. So at least there was some form of normalcy. But for me, it was like, you know, trying to figure it out, man. And I didn't have time to really grieve. It was just, I had to go. I had to focus on keeping us alive, thriving, surviving, the whole thing. And so it put me in a place where, like, there was no opportunity for writer's block or creative blocks. Like, I had to go. I had to think of ways creatively to take what I had to make something else, right? So if it's like selling a bunch of t-shirts that I go print out, if it's, you know, making a thing that I can make multiples of or whatever that was, I was doing it, right? I'm damn near like a used car salesman with a hot car on the lot. Like, I'm calling everybody I know, doing whatever I can to just stay away from having to take a fucking shitty 9-to-5 to help us live. And, you know, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, a year, it's actually starting to work. Okay, I'm selling some work. Damn, I got this opportunity. Y'all gonna pay me how much? To do what? Oh, hell yeah. I'll do that 3 times over for that. Once I kind of got into the flow, it just became the norm. So yeah, it's 2007, 2008, right? And things were sort of picking up and being lucky, right? Like meeting certain people that are like, man, I believe in what you're doing. Heard your story. How can I help you? So there was a family in Chicago, a very long history in Chicago, the Cacciatore family. And they had a space. It was an old mattress factory. He was trying to convert into, like, you know, art spaces, loft, studio. And he was looking for like an anchor tenant, somebody to kind of show off like, hey, look, they're doing this thing here. You should come here and be like them, basically. And his son, you know, Joe Jr., I met him. And this was kind of part of his brainchild. And so he gave me this space. And then, dude, it was crazy. With me being in there, and I'm not taking sole credit, but it became the epicenter for Chicago culture. It was a huge building. By end of year one, being in there, you turn around and Joe Fresh Goods is in there. You know, you've got Leaders in there. You've got all these different brands, folks that, you know, South Side, North Side, West Side, barbershops, whatever, you sell black soap, you in there, right? But all these people that have gone off to do certain things, you know, Ryan Henry, who has Black Ink, you know, on VH1, like Ryan's in there tattooing in a little, you know, a little small little closet of a studio at first. But all of us were in there at the same time. Andrew Barber, Fake Shore Drive, not knowing, obviously, or realizing what a moment that was and what it had become, but it just became a thing. But without them, right, having that belief in a lot of us and pulling us in, you know, I don't know if I'm sitting here having the same conversation, right? But that was another person that sort of just believed and helped. There was one moment where I had this studio. There's these Chinese artists that live in Chicago, obviously from China, the Zhao brothers. And within certain circles, they're very well known. They had created a studio space for artists on the South Side in Bridgeport. When my mom was still alive, she kind of did her best to try to connect me. And they were abstract artists, but they lean into more of the commercial side too, because like they had guided tours through their studio and all this stuff. And it was like really seeing for the first time a successful artist studio, right? And how they do it. And you know, you leave that guided tour, you come out, kind of exit through the gift shop. You want to buy a Zhao Brothers book, a t-shirt. And being around that environment and kind of going back and back and back to their space and going and seeing the other artists, I was like, man, I have to work in here. This environment is crazy. It's great. And so I got my first real studio, like that wasn't associated with work. That's where my studio space was. On the first floor, they had a gallery, huge gallery, but it was a gallery for masters, right? There was a lot of them, their friends. You know, they would invite a master marbleist that, you know, did these incredible marble statues, and that's what they would show. It was a complete disconnect with, obviously, the other tenants in the building, but, you know, it brought in the folks. They sold work, et cetera. And so I kept bugging them, like, man, you need some young blood in here. It's like, no. It's a rule. I'm like, whose rule? It's like, it's our rule. It's like, well, rules can be broken, right? Like, and so over the course of like 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, they started seeing, like, we would have open studios. And they started seeing that, like, when it's time for everybody to leave, everybody's still back in my studio looking at my stuff. The energy's there. It's undeniable. And so I convinced them to give me a show. And they did. My first big solo show in a real gallery. Crazy attention. And that was, like, the first big flyboy show. That was like, okay, I played around with this thing long enough, done different iterations. Now I want to do a show that's specifically geared towards Flyboy and my characters. And never looked back. The city was on notice. You know, it was like publications, write-ups. You know, the show was supposed to go for a month. It went for two. You know, the work sold the fuck out. You know, there was the demand started coming. People were asking about more. But with that show, I not only just did the show, but exit through my gift shop. I got t-shirts, you know, I've got little collectible figurines, I've got hats, hoodies, stickers, posters, prints, all of that. And I sunk everything I had into that show, like monetarily too. And it proved to be a success. And, you know, I did that riding the backs of these characters and it worked. I think I was also fortunate enough to have certain people around me at the time, like one of my oldest friends and, you know, people that I love for helping me on this journey is an artist named Fahamu Peku. And, you know, he's an Atlanta-based artist. And Fahamu was like the first artist I knew that had sort of broken through to, you know, like mid-tier, you know, Chelsea galleries. Fahamu wasn't the guy to be like, yeah, I did it, ha, ha, ha. Fahamu was like, man, I did it, come on, let's go, right? And he opened the door to bring me into that world and that space. And again, that was, you know, the steps that I needed, but I had spent all this other time just bubbling, cooking, learning, you know? And so when that opportunity came, I was ready.
After the success of his first solo show, Brantley's Flyboy character had entered the cultural zeitgeist and made Brantley a local star. With the city of Chicago already behind him, national attention and acclaim soon followed, and the inbound opportunities right behind them.
At what point did you feel like you had arrived in that virtuous cycle where one thing is leading to the next and you no longer have that fear of looking down?
I think when I'm at a position where I'm having dinner with the mayor of Chicago, right? And he knows exactly who I am, what I do, and feeling like I'm invited into, you know, another circle where it's just like, you know, it's that line from The Dark Knight, where he's talking to Harvey Dent, he's like, I'm not up for re-election for X amount of years. He's like, no, you don't get it. With my group of friends, like, you'll never need to do this again. It's not to say that I was falling into the Illuminati, but, you know, when your circles change and you're around individuals that are the ones responsible for greater change, whether that's locally or nationally, being able to lean on others and look towards others, right, for guidance that have already made a name and made a way for themselves. I'd never had mentors in that way. Never knew anybody that was more successful than my dad, you know? And so now finding myself through my art, right, these people are patrons of the arts, finding myself in circles with very successful business people position me to help me, you know, make decisions and navigate certain things. It's just a confirming moment that, like, if I just listen, you know, apply what they're telling me, I'm going to be just fine. You know, the art will take care of itself. That's not going to go in, unless I lose my hands. And even then, I'm just going to draw on some my left foot shit. You know what I mean? When your social circles change for the better, that was a big moment.
How was the work evolving as you are becoming more successful? I imagine creating a bit of a feedback loop where you're receiving praise, scrutiny for certain things, criticism. How is that changing what you're making?
I think I'm just more aware of, like, the audience. It's not just people coming to look at art, but it's people investing in your art, right? People living with your art now. And so I think seeing what sells, listening to how people speak about this versus this, again, just watching engagement, you know, that helps me to a degree. And again, you approach things a bit smarter, you know, with a bit more experience and a bit more confidence each time because of those things.
At this point, are you suffering from any insecurity? Are you having any doubts? It is a slow road, particularly in fine art. Are you feeling as bullish in year four as you were in year one or when you started in school?
Like, a lot of artists aren't social people or, you know, have an awkward nature to them. I do, you know, but I also know how to carry myself and sell myself, talk to people about the things that I do. And so that was always in my favor. Like, again, the hustler mentality. I was selling T-shirts, you know what I mean? Like, to college kids and rappers and shit, basketball players. But, like, this hustler mentality of, like, I'm going to start making work and then going to get it off.
When did you paint your first pieces with the characters who I think we all sort of most closely identify with you? The Flyboy, the Frog guys, like, all that.
That came in the early 2000s, from sketches to early iterations to then finally paintings. They've definitely evolved. I don't really even remember what the absolute definitive first painting was. I can remember the first series of works where, like, there was enough to call it a series. But with that, it was like, that to me was sort of always imagined as a one and done proposition. Hell, some of the Flyboys or the characters at the time, they weren't black. They were just, you know what I mean, whatever color I had at the time. You know what I mean? Some of them were gray. Some of them were portrait toned. It was sort of a one-off thing. This is a thing to do. This is the thing that feels good at the time. The next show had nothing to do with that stuff. But there was an expectation to see that stuff. And so, you know, as an artist, for me, that was amazing. That means I did something that connected with more than just one or two people. It connected with, you know, a broader audience, and people were expecting to see, you know, a familiar face, so to speak. And so that was just light bulb, obviously, moment of, like, I got something here and I want to explore it further. I'm like, yeah, I got this thing, but that's not everything I can do. I'm going to do a show that's got, like, you know, a little bit of this in it, but then, like, it's got all the other shit too. And doing a few shows early on, and these were shows I was putting on outside of the gallery that were really disjointed, very ego-driven. It's like, look how cold I am. I've got so many styles. But, like, trying to cover all bases, and I realized, obviously, that, like, that's not the way to go. And so, you know, sort of pulling it all back and doing that next thing where it's really intentional in how I'm using these characters, what I'm saying with these characters, and really exploring, like, finding new ways to bring this thing to life. And so getting into sculpture really early on in my career, and, like, going to YouTube and watching tutorials on, like, how do I do sculpture? And, like, failing miserably at it, right? But then, you know, trying to find those people that know how to do it and can help guide me. And so I started making, like, these 3D heads, these, like, wall-mounted heads, right, with Flyboy and a few of the characters, because it transforms the space in a different way than just a flat, you know, two-dimensional painting. And it allows them to live sort of differently, and the audience engages with them differently. And so I got into sculpture, and then I got hooked on that.
At what point did Hollywood start coming and knocking on your door and start kicking the tires on potential adaptations of these characters?
I'd say within like the past 5-6 years, Michael B. Jordan had come to Chicago working on some film or whatever. I don't know what the full story was, but saw my art, connected with it, investigated it, saw Flyboy, that whole thing, understood kind of where the movement was, and just hit me on Instagram. And we started talking. And, you know, at this time, his stock is rising. I think he's about to do Creed. He's becoming Michael B. to that degree. And him having the connections here, you know, he's a child actor growing up in sort of in this environment, and then started to, like, throw my names around in meetings and then, you know, start to introduce me to certain folks. It just allowed me to see that, like, I have something that can live beyond this space and potentially in another space. And it was just kind of around that same time where it was like, you know, I had agents calling, I had different producers calling, like trying to tap in and see, what are you doing with, you know, these characters? What are you doing with this? What are you doing with that? And, you know, secretly, unbeknownst to all of them, I had always had ambition to be in this space, right? I went to college for this. And it was just the thing where it was like, it was kind of right place, right time, because I was at a point in my career in painting where I wanted to transition and do more, right? And how do I, you know, reframe these characters, recontextualize and put them in sort of a different medium and a different thing? And like looking at like a guy like Takashi Murakami, you know, and where he's taken his characters and, you know, not only done animation, but done, you know, feature length films now. That always appealed to me. And again, having those examples and seeing that it can be done was sort of like that foray into Hollywood.
People are kicking the tires on you to see what's up with your characters, but ironically, your first foray into Hollywood ends up being a live action short that you direct for Netflix. How did that happen?
You know, I shot a few music videos for some friends and, you know, sort of got the bug back and really wanted to do more. And I was gonna just shoot a little short film at the house, you know, something I wanted to do with my daughter. I got a call from my agent that Netflix was doing this emerging filmmaker program, and they wanted me to pitch a few ideas. And so I did, and one of them happened to be the idea that I was gonna do with my daughter, which was called Erax. They loved it, they wanted to do it, and made it happen. And it was a cool opportunity. It allowed me to sort of check off bucket list stuff. Like, you know, I got to work with Jim Henson's company and their Creature Shop. They created the characters for me. I've given them sketches and, you know, the design. But walking through those hallowed halls and like so much history there, and I grew up a Sesame Street, a Muppet kid. And so to be able to like have something from them and create and, you know, getting to talk with like Brian Henson to understand how to shoot with puppets and puppeteers. And, you know, it was a lot. It was a great opportunity, but it was also a great training ground to sort of learn, you know, how to work within a larger production. And
will we see Flyboy on the big screen anytime soon?
We will. I don't know how soon, but I know it's coming. You know, it's something that I've been working towards for a long time now. And I think that like opportunities are there and obviously growing. It's just about sort of aligning with the right one. But yeah, it's definitely coming.
So what is the bucket list?
I mean, the bucket list is, you know, obviously continuing painting, that'll never stop. But, you know, to do bigger shows, more experiential exhibition. And then on the other side is to, you know, exploring animation, you know, from shows to features, live action films, directing some, producing some, you know, all of these things are slowly being set up. It's funny, man, because it's like, you know, Hollywood, which I'm completely enchanted by in certain aspects, but also, you know, it's like, it's hurry up and wait. And I'm not used to that because if I want to create something, I just go and create it, you know, in the studio. I'm a very ambitious person, always have been. And I think that like, while the pendulum still swings in my favor, I want to try to jump at those opportunities and sort of, you know, seize the moment. We are in a real moment right now, I think, for Black creatives all around, where you look at Hollywood, right? And how that dynamic is starting to change. And the dominant stories that are being told are from our perspective. You look at fine art world, you know, it's like in the fine art world, I don't know what happened, but the gatekeepers finally figured out that Black is dope. Like Black is the new Black, right? And you have all of these artists from Africa and parts unknown that are of color that are actually selling at such a high level right now. And it's a real moment that hopefully will continue. But while we're here, while we're in it, I want to be able to participate in the way in which, you know, best suits what I do. I'm a fucking creator. I'm gonna create, I'm gonna make the shit I wanna make, and I'm gonna put it out how I wanna put it out. I'm not saying every idea I have is great, every at bat is a home run, but I get to control it, right? I get to control my shit the way I want to within my lifetime. I can't control how it's gonna come out when I'm dead and gone. But for right now, these are the things I think are cool. These are the things I wanna participate in. And so I do. I can't live my life or base my career around somebody else's rules or laws. Like, I have to just go for what I feel is right, do the things that I wanna do, right? And not necessarily worry about how it's perceived by certain groups of people. If I'm okay with it at the end of the day, it's fine with me.
Hebrew Brantley's story is one of perseverance and adaptation. When film school failed to deliver a clear path, Brantley immediately pivoted back to fine arts by any means. And when his paintings failed to fly off the shelves instantly, he still found a way to stay relevant and paid, designing concert posters, drawing storyboards, and literally doing whatever it took to keep the lights on and keep working. And when he finally earned the acceptance of the fine art world, Brantley moved the goalpost on himself, creating new goals in the world of film and the adaptation of his IP. As a consequence, Brantley sits nearly two decades into a very successful career whose ultimate impact has only been teased as of yet. Big thanks to our sponsors at Shopify. If you're looking to start your own online store, check out shopify.com/ideas and become your own boss today.